This episode brought to you by way of our sponsors, Kinetic Performance Dog Food. Kinetic's line of premium dry food and supplements provides clean, sustainable energy for everyday active, sporting, and working dogs. Visit kineticdogfood.com for details. And Highland Hideaway Hunting Preserve in Riverside, Iowa, with over 1,500 acres of meticulously managed and maintained preserve. Book a hunt today at highlandhunting.com. And now, on with our show.
Okay, we're here tonight, Jim Smith. Jim, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Wade.
We have a little project we're doing. I talked to you a little bit about it, where we're kind of going back in time and trying to talk about what it was like, bird hunting and hunting in general, and when you were growing up as a youngster and you know, based on your age. How old are you, Jim?
I'm 80.
You're 80. And Jim currently lives in Cedar Rapids.
Yes.
What kind of – you grew up in Minnesota, is that right?
That's correct. Northwest Minnesota, up in what we always referred to as the tundra.
The tundra. was it pretty cold up there at that time?
Yes, it was. I grew up on a farm, and our farm was about 40 miles from the Canadian border and very close to North Dakota. So it's real flat farmland, not a lot of hunting opportunities in the immediate area because it's real open, flat farmland, farmed road to road. So the way I learned how to hunt was with a Savage Model 20 hex barrel 22 long rifle pump. And we would shoot gophers in the yard. That's how I learned to hunt.
Yeah, well, now, your parents pretty much, is that how they made a living off the farm at that time?
Yes, yep.
And how many acres was the farm?
About 250,
okay.
which is about an average-size farm back then.
What's a typical day like there at the farm for you and your siblings? Did you have siblings?
Yes, I have an older sister and two brothers, and my dad raised row crops for the most part. That was the cash crop, and then we had hogs and chickens and ducks and geese and beef cattle, and so it was almost like subsistence living. With four children, warriors, all those kind of things. Times were pretty tough. Had a crop failure in 43, the year I was born. So it was whatever was there, that's what we basically lived on.
So you had all these animals. None of them were pets, I take it. They were there for a purpose, right?
They were there for a purpose, all
okay.
of them.
Yeah. And you told me, I think, that when you had extra chickens and ducks, that you would sell those off to neighbors or to, was it a local store?
Local grocery store. My mother was kind of in charge of the chickens, so we would buy about 1,500, I think was the number, every year, and that was enough for our family. And then all the extras, it was kind of pre-planned that the grocery store would buy them, so all the farm families would go into town. Typically on Friday night was the big night for everybody coming in and shopping. So the grocery store, that was their big day. So Thursday night, we typically were butchering 30 to 40 chickens to take them in fresh to the grocery store for all the customers on Friday night when they come to town.
And your mom was in charge of that operation?
My mom was in charge of that. I was kind of the killer, take the heads off, and my sister and two brothers would pluck them all out, and mom would kind of take care of cleaning them out the inside, but then all of us were involved in picking the pin feathers out of them and washing them in the great big wash tubs.
Yeah, my grandparents had a small farm and a few chickens, and when it came time to, you know, find one for for Sunday dinner. I was the catcher. I got that big wire that had the loop on it. I'd go out there and try to catch him by the leg in the pen, and that was my job. But I've seen that process, and it's I've heard people say that they'll never forget that once they grew up doing that.
It wasn't the most pleasant thing to do. Mom would have to round all four of us up wherever we were hiding out in the windbreak or whatever, doing our thing. We always tried to stay away as long as we could because none of us relished the idea of Mom hollering at us and getting us all lined up to do our thing. But we willingly did it once she corralled us all.
Now let's talk about wild game and how that kind of figured into the household or to providing for the family. Was your dad a hunter? Would he go out and look for a deer during deer season? Or how? What do you remember about that?
No, deer hunting. Or there were very few deer around in our local area, and when I say local area, within about a 10-mile radius, 20-mile radius, because it was so open, there was no cover for the deer. Other than right along the rivers or stream beds or drainage ditches or something like that. So there was not a lot of wild game, per se. Rabbits and a few prairie chickens were all that was really there. And if we seen prairie chickens, nobody really shot those. We all kind of, they were, the neighborhood would kind of say, let's leave them, let's get a bigger population of prairie chickens in the area.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So even back then, there was some limited numbers of those prairie chickens in that area then at that time.
Correct. Huh. And I think that, if I recall right, I believe the population of the prairie chickens was going down in the 50s and 60s already because of lack of habitat for the most part.
Now, so at some point, obviously, you left the farm and went to school. What was your educational training?
I always liked design work and kind of had a feel for architecture, designing homes and that kind of stuff was kind of my goal as I went through high school. But then once I decided to go to college, I decided mechanical engineering was probably where I wanted to go. So that's what I did. I went to Wappan State School of Science. It's a kind of a, today you'd call it and get an associate's degree in industrial design or something like that. And that's what I did. And coming out of there, I got the opportunity and a job opportunity in Cedar Rapids with the electronics company.
And what year would that have been when you kind of moved to Cedar Rapids?
1963.
63.
Yeah.
Now, what was your experience with pheasants up to that time?
I had never seen one until I come to Iowa.
Now, you went to school in North Dakota, though, right?
That's correct.
And you never saw a pheasant while you were up there in North Dakota?
No. Again, we're in the part of North Dakota, the eastern North Dakota, is pretty flat.
Just not a lot of cover for those kind of birds.
Not a lot of cover. Really? It's still in that Red River Valley area. But if you didn't have to go from where I was going to school in Wahpeton, North Dakota, it was only 50 miles and you were into some pretty good bird country. But at that time, hunting wasn't necessarily number one in my mind. All of us were looking for the most pretty girl that we could find on a street corner and go to the movies with.
And so then you come down to Cedar Rapids, and then somebody mentioned probably pheasant hunting along the way, one of your coworkers or somebody like that. How'd that all come about?
When I come down here in 63, I come down with about five or six other guys that were classmates, going through the same curriculum that I was going through. And they were kind of outdoor guys, and we all wanted to, we weren't, we're all country boys, so we and mostly farm kids. So we decided we just needed to look for something to do, something cheap, because none of us had any money. Most of us were either deferred from the mandatory draft at the time and just looking to have a good time as young guys. So we a couple of them had grown up in rural Iowa, so they knew about pheasants. So I think it was the first fall I was down here, we all went out and got bought shotguns and decided we're going to go pheasant hunting.
So what was that first shotgun, if you recall?
870 Remington pump.
870 Remington pump, yeah. That's the old reliable.
Old reliable. I still have it.
You still have it?
Yeah.
And so your group decided to go pheasant hunting when it was like an opening day. It was going to be a big, kind of a big deal, or how much do you remember that?
I think it was the other guys probably were aware of the season whenever it would open, and we just decided it was kind of getting cool in the fall, and that might be a good thing to do, so that's what we did. But it got to be pretty much every Saturday that we would go out and pheasant hunt. Not long, a couple hours, but in a couple hours, everybody would come home with a bird. We didn't have any bird dogs at the time or anything like that.
Now, I think you told me that you kind of would hunt railroad right-of-ways and those kinds of things, fence
we
rows.
We did. Anything that looked brushy, where it looked like there could be birds, would do that. Got to know a few farmers that would let us in on their picked corn or standing corn at the time.
Back then, probably everyone was pretty, as far as landowners and farmers, they probably were pretty easy to get along with to let you hunt back
then if you ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember up around little town of Elburnett, there was a farmer up there. Railroad track kind of went through his farm. He got to know us traversing through on the railroad right away and hunting. And we'd ask him if we could come in, and he was very gracious to always let us in if his corn was picked or whatever. And sometimes he would just say, go into it, standing corn, there's birds in there. You know, so it'd give us pointers on where to go to find the birds.
And he's probably one of those guys that left a little standing corn on the edges or in the corners sometimes to help the birds out back then, or not?
Yeah, I think he did. He runs some livestock, so most of his farm fields were fenced, and you know, he didn't worry about picking at all because he knew the cattle would go out there and forage up whatever he missed.
And I'm sure the way agriculture has changed back then, there was probably a lot of cover in the rows as well, I would guess.
Yeah, I remember plowing through some corn that was only about head high to the top of the tassel, but you were plowing through foxtail and cockleburrs and everything else between the rows.
Now, at some point, you experienced that first flush of that rooster, right?
Yes.
Do you remember anything about that? Do you kind of have any?
Yes, I do, to a certain extent. A lot of times we'd have a few redneck hunters that were part of our group of six or eight guys that would go out. And I remember one time distinctly just missing birds all the time, trying to get used to adjusting to shoot below them if they're going up, or get on top of them if they're flying up, and learning the flight path of the birds and stuff like that. But the first time I knocked one down, it was a real pleasure. And probably that's what hooks you on bird hunting, is being able to harvest a bird.
And you would have been how old in 1963?
I was 19, 20 years old.
20 years
old. Yeah.
And so now, 60 years later, you're still out there doing it, right? You're still hunting birds?
That's correct. Still went hunting this fall three different times. I probably really got the bug when I met my wife. She was a farm girl from Central Iowa, and her dad was a farmer, and she had two brothers who were farmers. So all of a sudden you get that opportunity to have almost exclusive hunting rights to a tract of land, and they run hogs and sheep and no beef cattle or anything like that. It was basically hogs and sheep. So there was a lot of brushy cover around the corners of the farm fields and those kind of things.
So there'd be kind of, excuse me, so it'd be kind of like the family traditions of at Thanksgiving or at Christmas that you would have hunts with your family on that property?
Yes.
Okay.
My two brother-in-laws, they were, one was a farmer, another one lived in Cedar Rapids. And so we'd go down to my mother and father-in-law's place typically for Thanksgiving, and then we would go out for a couple hours in the morning and hunt.
And that was kind of, I mean, that was kind of the traditional way hunting was approached back then, because like you said, when you had I remember opening day when I was growing up, that was a big deal. You know, my uncles and cousins and everybody showed up at Granddad's farm to hunt that. You know, you didn't want to miss that one weekend of hunting. And I know that when I came to Iowa in 1977, in the early 80s, it was still, Iowa was a hot destination for pheasants. People were coming in here from all out of state and all over the place. But it was more of a traditional kind of a family holiday, if you will, opening day of pheasant season. Is that kind of how it was, your memory of it back then?
For a few years after I got married. I got married in 65. So through about 70, I kind of hunted with family, but I had a couple of real close friends from when I first come to Iowa. And a couple of their friends got together, and then all of a sudden we started going down to my wife's family farm, and that was our destination always. About 70, 1970, 72, when most of us were in National Guard or Army Reserves, so that kind of took out a weekend out of all our, and we're in different units. So when we could get together for a Saturday and a Sunday, we were out there bird hunting, and that was about the time we started having dogs. I had a black lab flush dog. One of the other guys had kind of a mixed mutt, but he was a good bird pointer. And then we really hit it heavy in the 70s.
When you get that dog, everything kind of ratchets up when
yes,
you get
it does.
That dog, because you feel obligated. You need to get that dog out in the field.
Right. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that lab.
It was a female, very laid-back dog. She was my hunting dog, but she was also the family pet. She would go out, and I remember a couple times just taking her out by myself on a Saturday morning after we had children, and I would just go out to a farm field or something, and I remember one time distinctly, it was blowing snow, wasn't super cold, probably in the 20s, and we just walked the end rows, and there's some standing corn, and would just look down the rows and see a pheasant down there, and I'd let her loose, and she would go flush the bird. And we got three birds, just boom, 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 in about 20 minutes hunting those end rows of the cornfield.
And would she retrieve those birds?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she'd always bring them back.
What was her name?
Lady.
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 And so, but it kind of changes once you get that dog, right? I mean, when you're hunting by yourself, but with a dog as your companion, it kind of, now, obviously, you see things, you see the dog do things that nobody else gets to witness. But,
right. But it's kind of a big change from going with hunting without a dog to a dog, to train your mind to watch the dog versus watch the cover and where you're going and those kind of things. But it's another great part of the whole hobby.
So really you're kind of turning over the guiding to that dog and that dog's nose. And so now you're, instead of worrying about, well, this cover looks pretty good or not, now that dog's nose is kind of your guide and you're kind of following the dog. It's, and it spoils you, because then you don't want to, when you get a, you know, later on when you got a chance to go without a dog, or you probably said, well, this is really not as enjoyable anymore.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep. And the way all the habitat is today, it's almost a necessity to have a dog. It isn't a good hunt if you go out there and don't have a dog to retrieve the birds or help you find the birds, because the habitat is kind of so sparse and more spread out than it was like back in the 70s and 80s when we had a lot of brushy farm fields and those kind of things that you could go through.
And so the numbers were such back in the early 70s that the dog was really not that necessary. And if you couldn't find a bird, you just went on and got another one, really.
Right.
Whereas today, you know, we're more concerned about recovering that game. And the numbers are such that, you know, you want to make sure that if you take that resource, that you want to make sure that you find it and you don't leave it out there. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that dog becomes really valuable to you. But
Now that I think back, Wade, to kind of your question about when I was young versus when I was early family, kind of living paycheck to paycheck, going bird hunting, that was almost a necessity, because that brought meat home to feed the family a little bit. Not that we were destitute or anything like that, but it was always nice to have those pheasants to supplement your kitchen table.
Now, did you hunt any other species of birds, upland birds, at that time, or just mainly pheasants?
Just mainly pheasants. Once in a while, would find a covey of quail, but I'm just not quick. Never was quick enough to shoot a lot of quail.
I grew up quail hunting, and there is definitely an art to it. And the biggest challenge and Grandpa always tried to instill in us that you got to pick a bird and stay with that bird. That covey comes up and they're all going all over. Yeah. I never could. I couldn't decide. There was just too many choices. And mm-hmm. he always said, "You get to pick a bird and stay with it, and act like that's the only bird coming out of that covey." But easier said than done.
Sure.
And now, even if I picked a bird, I'm not sure I could catch up with it mm-hmm. in today's world. But they are sure fun to watch a covey of birds bust out. I still enjoy hearing that noise, that bumblebee hum when they kind of blow out, and watching them go all over different directions.
One story I guess I kind of remember of hunting with another fellow, and we had my lab, and we just run into three or four coveys of quail, and kind of we got a couple, and then we just kind of took a break and sat down on the edge of a farm field against a high fence row, and I think both of us kind of fell asleep, took a nap, while all the quail were coveying back up again, and we're trying to decide, okay, which group are we going to go after, because there's two coveys of quail at least in the area, and we kind of took a nap, and all of a sudden the dog kind of rousted me awake, and I woke up my friend Lauren, and I said, hey, it's time to go bird hunting again. And I think we did kick up one of those coveys, a couple birds, not a big covey of 12 or 15 or anything.
So that's kind of the days where you found a nice-looking log to sit down on or lean up against.
In this case, it was
drop your cap down over your eyes and take a little snooze and let those birds regroup and then hit it again. That's perfect. Yep. Yeah. What's all of us have those, particularly dog stories, but we also all have those stories that come to mind of a good friend or a family member, and you know those ones. If somebody said, "What's your favorite story that you remember from bird hunting. Do you have one that kind of comes to mind that just by looking at that 0870 Remington that you go, okay, I remember?
Yep, a couple of them. A friend of mine, Jim Duffy from Minnesota, he was quick on the trigger. He could get a shotgun up faster than anybody, but we weren't having a lot of luck kicking up birds, and we were in a farm field that had a couple of big rock piles. And he says, "Jim, come on, we're going to go over to that rock pile. There's at least two roosters over there." And so he went on one side of the rock pile. It was a good-sized rock pile, probably 100 feet in diameter, all growing up with weeds and grass around it. And he goes around on the backside, and all, I didn't hear nothing. And all of a sudden, there was this boom. And he shot this rooster from the hip. It was only about, he said, about 3 feet off the ground when it come out of that brush around the rock pile. And he just, it was nothing left of it. But that was always a funny story that we always said, okay, if there's birds in there, you got to go take Duffy along with you to make sure you got them, so that they didn't fly away.
You won't be able to eat it, but at least you'll get it.
Yeah.
And I've seen that, I've seen that happen a few times where the dog didn't even want to retrieve it. It was such a nasty mess. Yep. But so did you give him the business a little bit after that when he showed you the bird?
Every time that we'd go hunting after that, we'd always tell him to just wait a little bit and let the bird get out there a little bit further. And he'd say, yeah. I'll do that, but I can't say we ever retrained him to let him get out too far. He always seemed like he was the one that got all the good close shots, but that's mark of a good hunter, I guess.
So do you have guys like him that you hunted with primarily, I mean, most of your life, or there would be that one or two guys?
There was probably about six guys, and then we got our two of us had sons that we got involved in the group later on in years as they become teenagers. They were part of our group. And then as people move jobs and leave town and that kind of stuff, it kind of broke up that group a little bit.
And then did you have any subsequent dogs after Lady, or was that really your only hunting dog?
I had two other black labs after that, but they never were as good as Mom was. The other two I had were both pups out of litters that she had.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's hard to measure up to the
expectations.
The dog I had. You kind of establish that line, so to speak, and some of the other dogs sometimes don't quite measure up. But that's good, though. Black lab guy. Yep. Did you do any waterfowl with those labs, or were you mainly just an upland guy?
Only if we went down on the farm and happened to be some ducks on a pond or something like
then,
that.
Then she'd turn into a duck dog then.
Yep. Yeah,
would she water retrieve ducks out of the pond? I assume she would.
She would. And of course, there's never a water hole that she didn't like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Tile lines always have to go down to the tile lines to get a drink. And if there's a hole of water at the end of a tile line or something like that, many times she'd just jump in there and come out with icicles all over her after a while.
Now, you hunted this season. You mentioned that when we started.
Yes.
What's the biggest difference between hunting now, hunting today, than when you hunted in the past? I mean, like back in the 70s and the 80s.
Probably the patience. Well, I got more patience now to just watch the dogs, walk slower. Don't worry about getting to the end of the field in 15, 20 minutes if it takes an hour. So be it. If I get a bird or two birds or whatever, or the group gets a bird, that's fine. Don't worry about how many bring home anymore.
So the bird thing becomes kind of the bonus. It's really
that's right.
It's really watching the dogs, and then maybe watching other people enjoy the dog work as well. For
me, and just being out in the open country.
What's your feelings on the future of upland bird hunting? Are you a little concerned about how we can protect it or what we're leaving behind for the next generation?
Very concerned, particularly in the state of Iowa. Our rules and regulations really aren't upland bird friendly from a habitat perspective, and I'm a firm believer that habitat is the only way our bird population is going to stay. The wild bird population will stabilize or have an opportunity to increase. I think the climate change, where we're a lot warmer, we don't have the severe winters like we used to have. All of that, I think, is probably a good thing for the birds. Not necessarily good for the economy or anything when you have droughts like we had last year. Mm-hmm. But
well, I'm sure there were days when you were growing up and early on when you were hunting, you know, when we'd have those real brutal winters in Iowa, you probably would see them freezing to death or starving to death because they couldn't get at food. And we don't really see that as much anymore.
No. And even into the early 2000s, down on the family farm, I would load up a backpack of corn or soybeans and carry it out and scatter it out. Since about 2002, 2003, 2004, somewhere in there, when we had some heavy snow and ice winters, that was really when it really took a toll on the birds. But I've never had to do that since then. Wade, it kind of reminds me of when I was over in Benton County with six of the guys that I used to hunt with a lot back in the 70s, 80s, early 90s. This was probably a mid-80s when the bird population was really great here in Iowa. And on Saturday, we had hunted edges of some farm fields and everything. We asked this one farmer if we could go on his field, and he said, sure. And he said, if you guys are back here on Sunday morning, I'll be out here picking corn, and I know you guys are safe hunters and everything. He said, why don't you just come out here and walk along the combine as I go through the field, because the birds are flying out all over the place. And we get out there about mid-morning on Sunday, and he has already taken this 160-acre flat cornfield, and he had run strips through it and harvested out rows of corn. So he only had probably 24, 36 rows of corn standing. So then he had drive the combine down.
And then it's open on the sides of those rows, right, where you guys are going to march?
So he... one would walk beside the combine, the other, another guy, if you wanted to get in the cornfield or take the next strip over, because most of the time the birds, when they flush from the combine, they're going to go back into the standing corn. So we just had a blast for a half a day hunt out there, come home with our limit after about 4 hours of hunting. What a pleasant farmer to be gracious enough to let us come in and hunt birds on his farm. That was just absolutely great.
So the sky was dark with birds, huh?
It was. We would see 50 birds in the air sometimes all at once, all heading in the same direction. It was just fantastic.
And that's the things people today don't, unless you saw that.
Right.
Like you did. I mean, yeah. You hear people say, oh, the sky was black with pheasants. You go, oh, the hell it was, you know, But, yeah, I mean, there were times when there was, like when I was in South Dakota, and I didn't care. I just wanted to stand there and watch them. There's so many birds. It was just a beautiful thing to watch. But But it was true even here in Iowa, it sounds like.
Well, and I remember that on the family farm, being down there, you know, it'd be all as many as two or four or six guys. We would be going through the CRP field or a pasture, particularly CRP in the, probably in the 70s, and it'd be nothing to see at least 30, 40 birds just in a rolling move in front of us as we went through those fields with the dogs. So many times we went down there and it'd be a four-hour hunt and everybody had his limit and come home and have a few beers and go back out and do it again on the next day.
And back then you didn't think that that would ever change, right? I mean, you gave no thought that these birds someday will disappear.
Absolutely never thought of it. And it was really devastating to us that hunted a lot. Mm-hmm. And I would say at that time, this group of six of us, we were hunting every other weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah. Now you think you're probably the only one left that's still out there.
I am the only one out of that group that's still upright enough to make it through a CRP field.
If I can just throw a question out there for you. Are you aware of any kind of programs? Like there's obviously still a CRP program of a sort for farmers, you know, that incentivizes them to plant that kind of croppage and maintain that type of habitat. Was it starkly different back then, or was that just something farmers tended to do?
I think it was the CRP program was the big thing. There were nationwide, there were 37 million acres of CRP in the 80s. And then USDA started cutting that back. So their cap, I think in probably 2016 with that farm bill, they cut it back to 22 million acres. So then there were tremendous number of acres in Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas that were pulled out of that CRP program. And I shouldn't blame it all on USDA. The farm commodity prices started to come up where farmers could make a lot of money growing corn and beans and wheat or whatever, small grain crops.
And so the foundation of the program originally was that you as a landowner could take kind of subpar acres and they would pay you so much per acre for you to put that into some kind of grass cover for habitat. Is
that's
that how
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you applied to the USDA for that program.
Correct.
But back in the 80s, there were so many acres enrolled, it was probably easier to get in the program then, wasn't it?
I wouldn't say it was easier to get in because it was kind of competitive bid back then. If you wanted to enroll ground, you were probably bidding against another local farmer or somebody in the county because they had parsed up the acres based on highly erodible land or the land that wasn't good for production. But then you had to submit a bid. And if you bid too high per acre, then maybe you didn't get it re-enrolled.
What's your recollection of what they were given per acre back in the 80s? Do you remember what that program was paying landowners back then?
Probably in the $70 to $100 an acre range.
And you have a few acres in currently, don't you, in that same program?
That's correct.
What's the price range today in compared to then?
They got a cap on it now at $298 an acre.
Really?
Under the current farm bill.
So for some farmers, depending on the land that they're able to get in that program, that might be a pretty good source of income, especially if you're retired or you're really not in, you know, you're an older senior person that wants to kind of retire from the farming, and it might be a way to maintain your land. And
yes, it is. And I wish that I wish that in the case of Iowa, that they would pass some legislation to protect stream edges and those kind of things we refer to as filter strips in the CRP program, to keep some of that fertilizer and give some habitat along the creeks. It preserves the soil from being washed away when the creeks flood and those kind of things. And it's great habitat for the birds.
Now, I think they have that program in Minnesota, don't they?
In Minnesota, I think it's like 35 feet from the edge of a creek or a waterway or a ditch that you cannot form. And that's really boosted the number of acres and the habitat available.
I'm sure that would really help the number of birds, I would think.
And what's driving that is the lake region and the tourist industry. That's what got the state legislature in Minnesota to realize that they had to do something, because there's some lakes and rivers that were good fishing grounds that were just getting devastated by the fertilizer runoff and the soil erosion coming in there and dirting up the
starting to silt in. And, okay. Yeah.
In your estimation, what's the best way that you can think of, at least, or maybe the most effective way that we could, and by we I mean the state, could incentivize farmers to pick up that kind of planting and that kind of program?
There are a couple little minor programs. They've got they call it SAFE, and I can't remember what that acronym stands for, but it's basically to create in the southern tier of counties in the state of Iowa more quail habitat. So then the state or DNR, I don't know where the funds come from, but they can incentivize the landowner in the CRP program for a couple extra dollars an acre if you then plant the appropriate cover crops and shrubs and those kind of things to create quail habitat. So that's a good program. I think this creek edge feathering, prevent it from being farmed, I think is a good thing, because I know areas where farmers disc and they have two or three blades on their disc hanging over the creek bank and pushing dirt down the creek just to get that one extra row of corn. And that bothers me a lot, that we're not more in tune to that. I guess if you look at today's legislation where the Farm Bureau was pushing it real hard this year, and I think we finally got the bill killed, where they wanted to, how do I want to say it, wouldn't let conservation groups or the DNR buy any more land or have, like Pheasants Forever, throw money in the pot with the Iowa National Heritage Foundation to acquire land for parks and recreation. That's another area we just got to keep on working on, so we don't let that kind of legislation come to pass.
They view that as farm ground that's out of production or going out of production, whereas...
Correct.
Or somebody could be farming that, and
correct.
Now it's...
And a lot of it is timber, floodplain ground. You can't build on it. So why would you want to farm it? Let it become a natural area, or improve it as a natural area where the population can enjoy it, and let the, you know, the state of Iowa is one of has the least amount of public area of all the states, all 50 states. So if we're going to get people to come to Iowa and have something other than work life, want to raise a family in the outdoors, we got to create more public areas.
And obviously you and I know each other through Pheasants Forever. It's an organization that we both have been involved in for many, many years, but it's that same thing that as you get into our age bracket, you know, we're looking at what are we leaving behind, mm-hmm. and will there be a upland hunting with dogs, or right. or will you be able to take your kids out and on a Sunday or on a Saturday and hunt like we grew up doing? And I guess the jury's kind of out on that sometimes.
I think it is. And, of course, technology and the things, it's hard to convince kids with all the other activities, soccer and football, baseball, basketball, all the other sports, to really get outdoor sports and get the younger generation involved in that.
Well, like you said, it's about the habitat, and I don't know that we'll ever see the glory days when we had CRP everywhere, right. Like we did in the 80s
right.
In Iowa. But from what I could see, that if you do have some sustained habitat, the birds will – you'll have birds, you know.
Oh, sure.
But as you said, in the minute you lose that habitat,
right.
The birds are going to start disappearing as well. And so
yep. –
And anybody that's walked in on a wild rooster that flushes in front of you on that dog's nose, it's very addictive, and so yes, you've got to do it again, and yep. no matter how yep. old you get, right?
Yep, that's right.
So the flushes that you got this season, were they just as good as the ones that you got when you were in your 30s or in 40s?
Yeah, you still get that rush.
Yeah.
You get that rush when the birds start to come up. You know, it's been so bad for the last decade or 15 years. It's very difficult to see enough birds to really say that you're out there hunting. And now that they come back pretty good in the last 2 or 3 years, it makes it a lot more fun when you see more birds. But when it's not even hunting season, I enjoy being out there, hearing the birds, sitting in a deer stand, hear the birds come in the evening and cackle as they're coming in, sit down. I get as much enjoyment out of that as carrying a gun out there and flushing birds.
Well, plus every time you see that rooster or hear that rooster cackle, if you're like me, it has a way of bringing back a lot of memories of years past. And so keep hunting. How many? You're going to keep hunting for a few years yet?
As long as I can walk. as long as I can walk.
I think you and I wanted to get out this year, and I kind of had this knee thing. And so maybe next year I'll be ready to – we can go out and enjoy some dog work.
Anytime.
We'll hopefully see a couple roosters and enjoy it like a couple old guys should, right?
Yes. Anytime you feel like you're ready to roll, give me a call.
Jim, it's been fun. Appreciate you taking the time to tell us some history about your hunting experiences. I think it's fun.
Thanks, Wayne. I appreciate it.